This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, June 26th, 2023. I'm Lou DeVizio. Hi, everybody. I hope you're doing well after the weekend. Here at NMPBS, we're certainly working hard. We have a special episode of the show coming your way next Friday night. It's going to be completely focused on the state of journalism in New Mexico. I'll have more to say about it in the next week here on the podcast, but keep an eye out for some of the interviews that we'll have, including a one-on-one with Albuquerque City Council President Pat Davis, who also owns four newspapers. That's The Paper, The Corrales Comment, The Sandoval Signpost, and The Edgewood Independent. Executive producer Jeff Proctor asks him why he decided to buy an alt-weekly and those other community papers, and if he has any concerns about the wider idea of media consolidation. We're also going to have a couple more interviews with prominent journalists here in the state and two panel discussions. It's all still coming together, but we're really excited for what should be a uniquely informative look at the successes, challenges, and shortcomings of the media ecosystem here in New Mexico. In the meantime, here on the podcast, let's get right into the headlines. Prosecutors have dismissed all but two of the criminal charges against former University of New Mexico athletic director Paul Krebs. Krebs is scheduled to begin trial in the next few weeks for allegedly using public money to pay for a 2015 golf trip to Scotland. The 66-year-old is now only charged with two counts of embezzlement for allegedly using the money from the university and the Lobo Club to pay for the trip that included himself, family members, several prospective donors, and former UNM men's basketball coach Craig Neal. According to reporting in the Albuquerque Journal, a spokesperson for Attorney General Raul Torres says the decision to drop additional charges came after a comprehensive review, finding that the evidence would, quote, not support a finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, end quote. The investigation into Krebs and the initial charging decisions came under Torres's predecessor, former Attorney General Hector Balderas. The U.S. Supreme Court has dealt a major blow to tribal water rights, ruling the federal government is not responsible for helping the Navajo Nation secure its water rights. An 1868 treaty between the tribe and government doesn't contain a requirement to do so, by the majority's reasoning. The final vote was 5-4. Conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch joined the three liberals on the court in dissent, saying the tribe was merely asking the federal government to identify its water rights and was not seeking dramatic further steps. Gorsuch added that as tribal members have had to do throughout their difficult history, quote, they must fight again for themselves to secure their homeland and all that must necessarily come with it, end quote. The lack of water and infrastructure to transport it across the more than 17 million acre reservation has been and remains one of the biggest challenges facing Navajo leaders. The tribe says the federal government has failed to keep promises and left members to suffer as the Colorado River runs directly along the reservation's border, giving away water to surrounding states. Andrew Curley, a Navajo member and professor at the University of Arizona, told NBC News that the ruling was expected, saying, quote, it's not surprising that the Supreme Court, a colonial court, would side with a colonial government. The power is stacked against tribes in this scenario, end quote. Our Land's Laura Paskus spoke to Curley about water rights and our society's role in limiting access and worsening droughts. Just head to the Our Land YouTube page and give it a watch. We begin the podcast this week with another decision from the U.S. Supreme Court that will impact tribal communities here in New Mexico. In a 7-2 decision, the High Court has upheld the primary underpinnings of the Indian Child Welfare Act, giving priority to Native families during adoptions or foster care placements of Indigenous children. Joining Gene on the Line opinion panel this week are Michael Byrd, a longtime public health expert and former president of the American Public Health Association, Dee Dee Feldman, a Democratic former New Mexico State Senator, and Trip Jennings, Executive Director of the digital nonprofit news site, New Mexico In-Depth. Here's Gene.
Now we begin this week with a decision out of Washington, D.C., where the nation's highest court voted to preserve a system that gives preference to Native Americans in foster care and adoption proceedings involving Native American children. That's the point here. The Supreme Court ruled 7-2 to uphold broad swaths of the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act. State of Texas and three white families kickstarted the case with a lawsuit claiming the federal law was based on race and unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause. Now, this ruling rejects that claim, and most tribal leaders across the country are celebrating the court's decision. And Michael, why is this decision so important for tribes and pueblos in New Mexico specifically? Now, we'll get to the nationwide stuff, but here in New Mexico, what's the bounce?
Well, I think the I think the bottom line is that the court ruled and acknowledged and ruled that that Native Pueblos, tribes, and nations are political sovereigns. And and that is something that is critical to Native communities in terms of protecting our people, children, protecting our land, protecting our rights to water, and so it's a validation. Not that we need to be validated, but I guess some people think so. But but it's a validation, acknowledgement, and validation of our legal government to government relationship, which everything is predicated on for Native people. If in fact the court would have ruled in a different manner, it would put in jeopardy so many of the things that underlie tribal sovereignty and tribal self-governance.
So it was a big decision, and in so many ways, it wasn't just about this.
Oh, it's much. The implications were much broader.
Right. Interestingly, Senator, before ICWA, you know, 95% of Native kids at the time before this were being placed with non-Native families. 95%. That's a phenomenal number. Something had to happen here.
It's shocking.
Yeah.
It's shocking, and it, you know, dates back to the boarding houses and the snatching of Indian children from their parents in order to make them into Anglos.
Right.
And this is something that has happened here in New Mexico, and it's really a great resounding victory because it was a 7-2 victory,
right.
which was really great. And it really did, as Michael said, really spoke to the sovereignty issue because, you know, I think people understand, this poor family that adopted the Native child. And by the way, it was a New Mexico case. It was a Navajo, Navajo child, I think. A mixed Navajo and Oklahoma. I think maybe.
Okay.
And anyway, so they were adopted by a Texas family, and now the Texas family wanted to adopt the brother.
Right.
And so everybody can say, oh, well, you know, it's just racial discrimination that you would want to put them back with the tribe. Or the original parents, but the great argument was, no, it's not, it can't be racial discrimination because this is another country.
Right.
This is like a citizen of another country, not a, you know, not a person of a different race. I mean, that's really precedent.
Right.
That's precedent.
Right. Interesting trip, Jennings, by the way, glad you're here. This was the third time Supreme Court has taken up an issue with ICWA. And what's interesting, Amy Coney Barrett wrote the majority opinion on this. It's very interesting.
Right.
To follow up, Senator, 7-2, some things are just apparent over time, but 2023, you know, I mean, you know.
When I when I read the stories, you know, I was thinking about the Kennedy Report in 1969, which was about schools, and the Merriam Report in 1928. There were two massive reports. This is the important part about history. You should know this history. But in Kennedy Report, there was this line that said basically that the boarding school history was always related to land policy. Always talking about land. And I see you smiling, but I mean, I read it with that larger context in mind, sort of saying, it did validate the political entities, which was huge.
Yeah.
But also knowing the history made me think, you know, maybe the justices were thinking, and Gorsuch has signaled that he actually does know some of this history in the past. With, I think it's McGirt, is that right, in Oklahoma?
Oklahoma.
Yeah, Oklahoma. And that yes, the justice who wrote the majority opinion probably saw this as a kind of an open shut case. And 7-2.
Does it feel more solid because we had that kind of?
You know, I want to say this, that it does leave open a challenge on race stuff. Everything I've read about that, Kavanaugh, actually, Justice Kavanaugh mentioned something about race being coming out, but I think it may be down the road a ways. That's
well, interesting. Alito and Thomas were the two that, of the 7-2. I'm not quite sure where they were thinking there, but anyway, pick up on what Triple's saying. Look, I got a point there.
Yeah,
What I wanted to say was that if you really don't understand this nation's history, and I'm not talking about 1492, I'm talking the very beginning of when there were people here for over 23,000 years, as we know, based on some evidence out of White Sands. So there were people. They had their own governance. They had their own communities. And if people don't understand that there are two foundational elements in this nation. Well, the first and foremost was the genocide and removal of Native people. And this history is well documented, if one wants to know. The second foundational element was slavery. And the history of there is there if people want to know. If you're seeking truth, you have to go some places that you may be uncomfortable with. But unless anything else is a false narrative, because there are plenty of false narratives that have been promulgated over the course of time. The only good Indian is a dead Indian. Kill the Indian, save the man. All of this is goes back for 500 years of history and policy, colonial policy and federal policy as it relates to Native communities. Mm-hmm. And it's relocation, it's assimilation. I mean, the boarding schools and the removal of Indian children was to basically erase Indian people as an entity. The genocide itself, physical genocide that took place, didn't do that. So what you see happening is, in fact, these assimilation policies. You see boarding schools. You see programs, termination and relocation. There was an effort to get Indians off the reservation back in the 50s. My family went to San Francisco, and it was to separate Native people from the land, probably then saying, well, if we can get these Indians into the cities, they'll disappear and become Americanized, and then we can probably move in on that land, because it's always been about the land.
There you go. Yep. Sorry, I want to stay with you for one quick second. Chip, I got you here in a quick second. Land rights. Dominoes falling over? Is this just one domino falling over, hitting nothing else? Or is this possibly going to lead up to some other issues, at least getting on the table for some fair hearing for Native American issues here?
Well, you know, it'll be... This is just the continuation of it all. It always comes back to Native people, Native rights, Native land, Native water, Native sovereignty. And it's about sovereignty.
Right.
And we are the only community, the only population. Yes, we are people of color, but we are the only ones that have treaties and a government-to-government
That's
relationship
right.
with this nation.
Right.
And I dare say this nation has fallen short in terms of fulfilling the treaties, fulfilling its obligation to Native people. American Indians to this day, pre-COVID, had the highest mortality, morbidity rates of any population in this nation. So much for the blessings of civilization.
By the way, Chip, speaking of chipping away at tribal sovereignty, there's other Republican-led states that were kind of getting in on this Texas thing. Texas was not the only one. We've got... So does this case, I got to ask again, does this possibly end that idea of chipping away at tribal sovereignty now that we've got some clarity here?
I can't predict the future, and I want to say that this law firm that was doing this also represents oil and gas companies.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about land. This is land policy, and
That's right.
what Michael was talking about, this is really key. I also want to say something that coming from not being raised in New Mexico, but learning a lot of the history here,
sure.
I think also that living here, you know, I've learned the history that pre-European, there was this the communities were very sophisticated, and they were highly organized, and there were trade networks from the tip of South America up to where Alaska and Northern Canada, which is similar to what you would see in the Middle East thousands of years ago and Europe and whatnot. This is probably, honestly, some of the communities in North America were more advanced than Paris and London. And so I think that that's important to point out, because I do think that there are people like myself who were raised who didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier to say, we need to take care of these children,
That's right.
when in fact, good Lord, sorry, that's my southernness coming out. Good Lord, when you read about some of the communities and how they, the holistic taking care of the communities, I'm still learning, but I'm kind of in awe.
We could learn a thing too. Yeah, about how community works. We throw that word around a lot in modern times.
We're getting new reaction to the Biden administration's 20-year ban on oil and gas leases in and around Chaco Culture National Historical Park. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland consulted with Native tribes before issuing the decision to enshrine a 10-mile buffer surrounding it. The All Pueblo Council of Governors, which represents 20 Pueblos, celebrated the action, saying it will protect cultural heritage, but the Navajo Nation's top leader, President Boo Nigrin, is disappointed. His government wanted a smaller buffer, saying the 10 miles eliminates economic opportunities for more than 5,000 Navajo allottees. The Interior Department says the withdrawal only applies to public lands and federal mineral estates, not minerals owned by private, state, or tribal entities, meaning Navajo allottees can continue to lease their minerals. New Mexico In Focus correspondent Antonia Gonzalez wanted to get more context around the decision, so she sat down with the chair of the Chaco Heritage Tribal Association to talk about what the Interior Department's decision means for Native tribes.
Brian, welcome to New Mexico In Focus.
Thank you.
Well, Chaco Canyon in northwestern New Mexico holds both cultural resources and is sacred to many Native nations. Please explain and tell us a little bit about Acoma's ties and other Pueblo communities.
Sure, yes, Chaco Canyon, or Washbashaka in our language, is one of the significant settlements of our Pueblo people. Our ancestors, at the time of emergence, were instructed that there would be some designated stops along the migration before we arrived at our permanent settlements. And the initial settlement was the Mesa Verde region, and that region is quite vast. It isn't the only in the Mesa Verde Park proper, but it extends east and further west of the Mesa Verde region. And then, you know, years later, the ancestors migrated to this place called Washbashaka, and it was at Chaco where there were a number of things that were to occur. It was really a time for our ancestors to really engage in the science of things. And, you know, these monumental structures were built. There was a study of both the lunar and solar cycles that then informed the advancement of ceremony and other cultural and religious observances. So because of those things and other factors, it's a significant ancestral site. We have ties either through clan or perhaps through some societies that cause us to return to Chaco, make that physical return back to the place for prayer and the observance of our respective cultures.
And your work as governor advocating for the buffer, not only here in the state, locally there, and also on a national level. Share a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, you know, my work with this issue began in the late 1990s. When I served as the director of the Pueblo's Historic Preservation Office. And during that time, the Pueblos were already engaged along with other tribes in the, advocating for the protection of Chaco because there was so much encroachment by the oil and gas industry. There was continued excavation, illegal excavation of outlier sites associated with Chaco. And so there were some significant issues at that time that were, you know, causing this concern. Fast forward to my time as governor in 2019 through 2021, you know, I had the opportunity to represent my Pueblo in the discussions with other Pueblo leaders, the Navajo Nation, and other tribes who have a cultural affinity to Chaco, to further advance this need, really, to protect Chaco. And, you know, there were also some other concerns that became paramount, including the protection of the environment, the land and the resources that were being impacted as a result of fracking and the extraction of resource from the earth.
So then what was your reaction when you heard that Secretary of the Interior De Pauland, you know, took this action?
Well, I was very grateful. And it's something that has been, you know, a long time coming. And it was really gratifying that the Biden administration recognized and finally heard the voices of the Native people and understood why we continue to insist upon these protections of Chaco. So it's monumental. But we also realize that there is still so much work to be done. I chair what's called the Chaco Heritage Tribal Association. And we are tasked with developing really the first ever ethnographic study of the Greater Chaco region for the purpose of informing the federal government and its agencies about the cultural significance of the place and the spaces that are Chaco. So, you know, I go back to the comment earlier that there's so much work still to be done, but this protection, at least for over the course of the 20 years, provides us the opportunity to educate and inform, and it will, you know, really sets the stage for advancing the discourse around the cultural protections, but also access to the resources, because as I said earlier, we do return to Chaco and outlier sites for cultural observances. And, you know, to ensure that this significant cultural resource is there for our future generations. And as a, you know, World Heritage Site, a national park, that it continues to be accessible to the public.
And Secretary Holland did travel to New Mexico recently for an event that shifted from the site to here in New Mexico. You were there. What did she say to you, and what did she say to the other guests?
Well, Secretary Holland had a bit of a day. You know, the intent was to have the event at Chaco Canyon this past Sunday. But because she and other tribal representatives were met with protesters who included that included Navajo Alatis, the event was canceled at Chaco and was rescheduled later in the day here in Albuquerque at the Bureau of Indian Affairs regional office. And it was a great occasion. Despite what happened earlier in the day, we came together to acknowledge this monumental decision of the federal government, and to give thanks, you know, to our ancestors, to everyone who has been involved in this effort. You know, the hard work, the prayers, and the dedication of many to ensure that these protections were realized. I did have a chance to speak with Secretary Holland, and I just said thank you. I asked her not to dwell on any of the negativity, and that she's in a tough place, you know, that she has a very important but a very challenging job, and that she will have to deal with these types of situations. But I assured her and reassured her that everyone who was there, and even those who could not be with us on Sunday, are praying for her and are wishing her well. And we're all very hopeful that as this work continues, that our work and our contributions towards this effort will lessen the load for her.
And I do want to ask you about that. As a tribal leader, tribes often unite on many issues, and there always are differing views, and from not only tribes, but individual tribal citizens. And the Navajo Nation has made an official statement as a tribal government expressing disappointment in the buffer for various reasons. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to work with President Jonathan Nez, along with other Pueblo governors, to create and introduce the first version of the Chaco Protection Bill, which is really a piece of legislation that ensures this longer-term protection of Chaco. That legislation has just recently been reintroduced by Senators Heinrich and Representative or Congresswoman Teresa Ledger Fernandez. Anytime leaders come together in this way, I have seen that it is very powerful. And it's a true act of our solidarity and sovereignty and our commitment to uphold our inherent responsibilities as Native people to protect our resources, to protect our lands, and our cultural resources, our sacred places. Because in the end, these sacred spaces will help to sustain our livelihood and our future, not only Native people, but all people. So I hope that moving forward, that our leaders, including the current president of the Navajo Nation, and others will come together and work together, that they will continue to communicate and negotiate in true government-to-government relations and in with a level of love and compassion for our people and the cultures that have sustained us for millennia.
Over the last 3 weeks, we've contacted the Navajo Nation President's Office and the Navajo Nation Council several times to get their side. We have not received a response. Now, in our final segment of the podcast this week, I'll throw things back over to Gene and the Line Opinion panel to talk about the recent Juneteenth celebrations here in New Mexico and how news organizations can do a better job of telling the whole story of New Mexico's Black communities.
This past week, the entire country and New Mexico and Albuquerque celebrated Juneteenth. Recognized on June 19th, the recently declared federal holiday marks the effective end of slavery in the United States. When the news of the Union's victory in the Civil War finally reached slaves in Texas, that was 2.5 years after the fact, the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. Now, according to Gallup polling, this is interesting. Just 37% of American adults said they knew something about Juneteenth in 2021. That's, of course, the year it became a federal holiday. 1 year later, that number doubled to nearly 60%. That's interesting. This year, groups across New Mexico held celebrations, events during the three-day weekend, and Senator, ranging from Black leadership discussion of Roswell to choir performances in Albuquerque, pretty good stuff. Let me kick this to Tripp, actually. I got a better question for Tripp. You're originally from Georgia. Let me go there. Did any of these events capture the spirit and purpose of Juneteenth? Because you grew up in, you know, around a lot of African-American people in Atlanta and Georgia. What's your take on New Mexico?
Georgia, and let me say that I did not know about Juneteenth until relatively recently, because it was kind of a Texas thing that actually did radiate out to communities of people who had, their ancestors had moved elsewhere in the country, but that was not something that I necessarily knew about as an observance and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I will say that, love the platform, that it's a holiday, that more people know about it. Mm-hmm. I also know that there is this internal conversation among black communities, which is, we've been celebrating this for a long time, and now you've got the rest of the country moving in, and it's like they're doing their thing, and then you have the corporatization, commodification of this thing, and I sometimes, I love history. I am someone who was, as you said, raised in Georgia, where the population is 35 to 40% African American. Martin Luther King's from there. I mean, and so I'm very aware of the history. I often wonder, like, if a holiday, it's good that people know about it, but I also wonder if people follow up with the hard work of really taking on the history and laws and policy that should follow in that.
So folks might not know this, Senator, there are 57,000 African Americans here in New Mexico, according to the U.S. Census. That's about the size of about a block and a half in New York or somewhere else. And just to make the point, when you have that small a population, it's easy to just dismiss and ignore, you know, whatever the case may be. So I'm interested in your take on how do we get into how press works here in media when it comes to African Americans, and, you know, there's health disparities that are very newsworthy. There are crime disparities that are very newsworthy. You don't read a whole lot of that. There are positive stories that are very newsworthy in the African American community. Don't see a whole lot of that. What's your sense of how the press takes on African American issues here?
Well, you know, it's first of all dates back to how the public sees African American issues, and how it's only relatively recently that we recognize New Mexico as a multicultural state rather than a tricultural state. So I think that's kind of the backdrop of how the media covers this community. And I think also, you know, one of the things that we have to look at in news coverage is who are the black leaders that are being covered? Who are the sources of information that are actually black rather than just white people talking about black people? And there haven't been that many of those. However, there have been. Some. In the past, and they have been legislators, and they have been there doing the work. Lenton Mowry, for example, in the 80s, introducing kindergarten for New Mexicans, and now we have Pamela Herndon, who is definitely a leader in the black community, and now is recognized as a community leader in terms of gun control and getting the only piece of gun control legislation, which was named after a black student who was killed at Washington Middle School. So, you know, things change very slowly, but there have been changes. It's not a complete standstill.
Good point there. You know, Michael, when you think about it, all of us watching as well, I think we'd all struggle to name more than a few black reporters, black media members here in not just Albuquerque, but Santa Fe, Cruces. If you really kind of added the whole thing up together, it's still not a whole lot of folks here. What's the issue there? Is it hiring, understanding black issues? Is it purposeful? What's your sense of it? Because it's been a long time now, and there's plenty of people who want these jobs, plenty of black people who want these jobs, don't seem to get them.
Yeah, I would say it's taken too long.
Yeah.
I parallel sort of some of my own experience as a Native person. Mm-hmm. And in New Mexico, we have greater visibility because our population is larger, and we have... We've held on to our tribal lands, and so it's, and not to mention, first those some tribes having casinos, and that benefited them. Sure. But my experience in many other places, Utah, for example, where the population, ethnic populations are very small, African American, Hispanic, Latino, Native populations. There just has to be a commitment. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't, you know, you could do all these public, we're talking about public relations efforts, and we're going to make a big deal out of this because our company can generate revenue off of this. There has to be something more than that. Right. There has to be a real commitment. And it's not going to come, it's not going to come from the people who are in positions that make those decisions. It really is going to come from us, right, holding them accountable, expecting accountability, right, asking for data, asking for I mean, because if people were going to be benevolent and smart and do the right thing, they would have already done that. Right. I mean, there's the Civil Rights Act. There's all of these. You know, in New Mexico, it wasn't for Miguel Trujillo challenge. I mean, Indians didn't have voting rights. Marine comes back from serving not unlike African Americans and many other communities of color, yeah, who served, and then they come home and they're disrespected. They can't vote. They can't buy property. They're ignored, marginalized. There just has to be sort of a moral reckoning on the people who are in positions who have power and privilege to recognize that you cannot marginalize and ignore anyone who's in your community. And it shouldn't be predicated just on what percentage of the population they are in the state. If you think that New Mexico's is challenged, travel to Utah and look at some of the broadcasts and look who the broadcasts are on all the major television stations. You see, I mean, it's God bless you, Utah. You got some work to do, but it's even worse. And I dare say it's I don't know what the percentage of the African American population is in Utah, but I would suspect it's probably comparable to New Mexico. It is. Yeah. And you don't see any ethnic diversity in terms of broadcast, people on the media. But getting back to the point, we have to ask and expect, and we will be rejected. I come highly rejected in some circles, and that's fine.
I know what you're saying.
But yeah, we can relate. We've been there. But if we're not holding people accountable and knocking on those doors, and it's not going to happen. It has to come from our community, and our communities need to be organized and say, and I think, you know, we need to also reach out to each other's and engage each other's and say, hey, you know, is this happening to you? Well, maybe we should have a conversation about, let us come together and begin to pursue these issues multiculturally. Mm-hmm. So it's not just one community, that it's all communities coming together to say, we have expectations of this country, of this city, of government, of broadcasters, and we expect to see some measurable change. And we're going to be holding you accountable. We're going to be looking for numbers. We want data. We want to see a change.
That's right.
That's the only way it's going to happen.
That's right. That's interesting. Good. I'm pleased you did that rant there, because I mean that in the best sense, rant. Because this is, you had to tie a lot of things together. It's not just an isolated deal. Mm-hmm. It's all connected. Mm-hmm. Let's finish the segment with you, Tripp. You've been in a position to hire and fire reporters for a long time now. The angle here is always, well, we can't find any, when it talks about minority people to work in the news business. And it's not about you when I say that, but as a hirer and someone that's obviously not African-American, how do you approach that as someone who is looking to diversify your own newsroom?
You know, with New Mexico In-Depth, and I've worked several places, Albuquerque Journal, Santa Fe New Mexican, New Mexico Independent, now New Mexico In-Depth. I think in the last, we are 11 years old at New Mexico In-Depth, we have made an effort to, and it is, we are trying to diversify our newsrooms, right, because we do know that, in my experience, I came out of newspapers, mm-hmm, and newspapers were primarily, at least my experience, white and middle class, right, all over the nation where I've worked, California, Florida, Georgia, Connecticut, now here, and that, you know, also having loved ones who are not white and middle class has exposed me to this idea of how much smarter I am when I have diverse voices that can challenge my assumptions about how the world works.
Gotta stop. Yeah, that's the perfect place to stop. Thank you so much to all you guys. Tough subjects tonight, but very necessary.
Thanks to Jean, Antonia, our panelists, and everyone else who contributed to the podcast this week. Thank you for listening, of course, and please keep an eye on our social media pages. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube throughout the week. We'll be posting updates and other news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio for Monday, June 26th, 2023. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.